This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Thanks, Dennis. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Kevin, Eli, Rosa, and I wrote this book, China and Global Capitalism, for several reasons. First, we wanted to explain the rise of China as a global capitalist power, attempt to explain its class and social struggle, and its projection of its economic, political, and military power into the world, and to explain how that has brought it into conflict with U.S. imperialism, obviously the global hegemon. Finally, we wanted to provide a way for the international left to respond to this rivalry, oppose both imperialist powers, and build international solidarity against this rivalry from below. Now, I don't think anybody at this conference has any doubt that the U.S. is the biggest imperialist power and the main enemy of humanity in the world. It possesses the largest economy. It has got the world's reserve currency, so the dollar. It controls the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. It stands astride a massive network of alliances, NATO being one, but a latticework of alliances throughout Asia as well as throughout the world. And it enforces its hegemonic rule through its military, which is by far the largest, and with the biggest military budget, and with 800 military bases all around the world, in particular in Asia, which people often forget and don't pay attention to. That is, the U.S. has been an Asian power for over a century. But now the U.S. faces another great power rival in China. China has transformed itself from an isolated, underdeveloped economy into now the world's second largest economy. It is the world's largest exporter. It's the world's largest manufacturer. It's one of the main recipients of foreign direct investment in the world, and it's a major exporter of capital, especially to the global south through its Belt and Road program. It has leapt up the value chain. It's not just a low-end manufacturer. It's now competing with international capital at the high end of high-tech production and in research and design as well. It has cornered the market on electric vehicles, on solar panels, and increasingly in whole sections of microchip production. So it's now a major competitor with U.S. capital, with European capital, and with Japanese capital. But as a new capitalist power, it faces all the crises and contradictory dynamics of capitalism. That is, crises of lowering profitability, economic crisis, recessions, overproduction. And in many ways, it's trying to export its internal economic problem internationally. That is, its overproduction by the Belt and Road Initiative, that is infrastructure development to develop third world economies so that they can provide raw materials for Chinese capital, and also to export its surplus product to the global north and global south. That's triggering trade wars that we're seeing as the reality that China is a more effective competitor to U.S., European, and Japanese capital. As they realize that, they're starting to erect tariff barriers because they're being undercut by Chinese capital in the world market. Based on this economic expansion, and especially under Xi Jinping, China has begun to proclaim itself as a great power in its own right, as reclaiming its status as a great power. That is fueling the geopolitical and economic and military competition that we're seeing with the United States. And China is very serious about asserting its geopolitical influence. It's crafted all sorts of international economic and political pacts. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is one, the BRICS alliance in particular, and many bilateral alliances. Most importantly, the alliance without limits with Putin's Russia. And it has buttressed this new geopolitical assertiveness with the transformation of its military into the second largest military in the world after the United States. And it is coming into conflict in particular with the United States and its regional allies in Asia. So the Asia Pacific has become one of the hot zones of this growing inter-imperial rivalry, in particular in the South China Sea, where China is trying to assert through building military bases claims to the region to control shipping lanes, that is international commerce, access to undersea natural gas and oil in the region, as well as fisheries. That's brought it into conflict with smaller nations throughout the Asia-Pacific region, and behind that, the United States. And it's also brought it into conflict with Japan, the fourth largest economy in the world, which is now remilitarizing with a vengeance in reaction to the rise of China. So China is now an imperialist power, and Xi Jinping himself has made no bones about it. So that has provoked this conflict with the United States as the regional hegemon, as the global hegemon that now feels threatened by this rising capitalist, economic, geopolitical, and military power. And this rivalry between the United States and China is the central inter-imperial rivalry of the 21st century. And it's impacting absolutely every corner of the globe and every conflict in every corner of the globe. The U.S. aims to hold on to its dominance, and China is determined to clear space to continue its rise as a great power in the world system. So there's tons of flashpoints that is created, in particular over Taiwan, which is one of the most geopolitical, economic, and military hotspots in the world, which is often off the radar screen for people in the United States. But this conflict over control of China is high stakes because 90% of high-end microchips are produced in Taiwan. That's key for international capital and for the militaries of the world, because we now have high-tech militaries that are utterly dependent on these high-end microchips. So in many ways, the battle over Taiwan is as significant as the battle over control of the Middle East oil reserves in the world economy. And so we're in the midst of this rising inter-imperial rivalry, and the biggest challenge for the international left is how we take positions on this, how we oppose, especially in the United States, the attempt by the United States to hold on to its rule of the roost of global capitalism, but lend no support to China as a rising imperialist power, but instead builds international solidarity among working people and oppressed people caught up in this rivalry to challenge them both and stop them from ushering us into an epoch of inter-imperial holocaust like we saw in World War I and World War II.
Thanks once again to Dennis and to all the organizers of the conference, and thanks to Haymarket for publishing our book. I should say a few more words about the book. It's very much a pandemic book. We collaborated entirely online over Zoom, hours and hours of conversations about what to write. And for anyone who has been writing, co-authoring books, articles, or about to or want to, you know, when you collaborate with four people or three other people, it's not easy, but it's also, when it works, it's a very delightful experience. So I'm glad to say it's the latter for us.
Especially because of Kevin.
Yes, I will accept that, but it's not true. and of course, the book is on sale, or it's being sold there in the Haymarket section. I think there's a few copies left. I should also mention at the beginning, I think the reason we are quite interested and concerned and write about and try to organize around U.S.-China conflict or rivalry was, for me, my background is on labor in China. I mostly do research and doing activism around worker struggles in China. So U.S.-China rivalry wasn't my primary concern up until maybe 2016. That's when, and in 2016, 17, when Trump was elected and the sort of anti-China rhetoric really ramped up. It was already starting under Obama, toward the later years of Obama administration, but it certainly ramped up in a big way after Trump was elected. And then the pandemic hit, and of course, he called it the China virus. And I think, you know, the direct impact of this here is the anti-Asian racism, but also stuff like the China Initiative, under which the U.S. government has been really interrogating researchers, academics with links to China, even if it's just an innocent link, research kind of collaboration. So for us, we organized an event back in January 2020 in New York City called The China Question, and a small volume e-book came out of that collection of talks through Verso. And then we start working on this book, really trying to write this as a more like an introduction to anyone on the left who want to understand what's happening in China and also what's happening with regard to U.S.-China rivalry, and actually just laid out the some of the roots of this and trajectory of this imperial rivalry. So we actually start the book with a chapter on China is a capitalist. It's kind of a strange way to start a book, but we felt it was necessary because in recent years, the question of what China is that capitalist, is that socialist, or is it some kind of non-capitalist formation, or is it something else, kind of resurfaced. And I say resurfaced because that has not been a question for a long time. For my own sort of political radicalization, yeah, we took for granted China. Whatever China was under Mao, it was certainly undergoing capitalist transition in the 80s and 90s. And by the mid to late 1990s, it was very clear China was capitalist. And also for me, because I have a labor background, I always look at this issue from the perspective of labor. If you look at the relations of exploitation, again, it's very clear from the 1990 onwards, with first the introduction of special economic zones, essentially are export processing zones where workers are put under extremely exploitative conditions. And that was very clear what the new society, what the new economic system that was emerging at the time was. It definitely in no way was socialist, that was not allowing any independent trade union or worker organizing. I think also it's interesting to think about why this question resurfaced. And I think in large part, there are many reasons. And there are always people who do not think China was capitalist, but I think it's resurfaced because of the U.S.-China rivalry, because now China become one of the number one enemies, if not the number one enemy. Now, then maybe if it's China, if the U.S. enemy, it must be doing something right. Maybe it's socialist, or if it's not socialist, at least it's doing something really well, you know, lifting people out of poverty and stuff like that. So I think that question resurfaced in the context of the escalating U.S.-China rivalry. I do think the role of the Chinese state and the character of Chinese capitalism is quite interesting, and that we do go into the in the book, we go into that, what actual characters are, how it emerged, how it developed since the 1970s and 80s. So we're not just inserting that claim, we actually try to elaborate that in the book. And I think what's interesting about the Chinese state is, you know, especially now you may read about how Chinese government disciplines certain capital in the, say, in the housing sector, in the financial sector, in the tech sector, and you may take that as evidence of somehow the Chinese state being being a socialist or on the side of workers. It's a kind of interesting discussion to have, but it both disciplines labor. It arrests labor activists, including many of our friends in China. At the same time, it also disciplines capital, which is interesting. And I think that's not a sign or evidence of China not being a capitalist state, but rather it's trying to manage to save itself from the worst of what's excess of capitalism, which we can go into in the Q&A section in terms of what's happening now. And I think the kind of economic transformation in China over the last 3-4 decades, you know, the deep integration of Chinese economy into the global economy is a really important story. And I think in many ways, it's a part of the story of neoliberalism globally. And in many ways, if you take China's economic growth out of the equation, the global economy barely grew in real terms over the last 3 decades. And of course, now it's China's own economy has been slowing down actually since the global financial crisis in 2007-2008, and from a high point of 14% GDP growth a year in 2007 to now about 5% a year right now. And so we'll see if the crisis of Chinese capitalism also become the crisis of global capitalism. And I will also mention something that I think we can, one of our co-authors writing the book is the crisis of social reproduction and the emergence of feminist movement in China. And China's birth rates, fertility rates has been declining for several years now. And I think last year was the first time in the last 60, 70 years when China's population actually started to decline, which is quite surprising for a country that until recently was very concerned about overpopulation. And I think that's not surprising for anyone who has been following the crisis of social reproduction everywhere, including here in the US. The cost of reproducing the next generation has just become too costly. And China is not alone, obviously. Some of the lowest fertility rates can be found in Asia, in Korea, South Korea, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, in Japan, etc. And along with that, there has been a kind of feminist movement emerging over the last decade or so, where women feel more empowered and are ready to challenge some of the traditional roles that are ascribed to them in society. And again, we can talk more about that. And it's that we have a chapter also in the book. So I think to finish my part of the question answer of, I think China kind of entering kind of really interesting and unpredictable period. So you have an economy that has been slowing down. You also have an economy that is less and less able to generate enough jobs. Again, not a surprise globally. That I think that China's story is not a Chinese story. It's a part of the global capitalist story of social reproduction, or crisis of social reproduction, crisis of jobs, crisis of, even if their job, it's very highly precarious, insecure, and doesn't pay well. And you are seeing more and more discontent among young people in China, around not just employment, just sort of general pessimistic outlook about where society is hiding. I think right now the government is able to keep that at bay by suppressing dissent and opposition in society. But I think that's going to not be able to keep the lead on the increasing and emerging discontent among the younger population in China for too long. So I think that's, you know, to me, the more I think about China, the more I wanted to situate that within a global story of what's happening. I think the crisis that China is facing is the crisis that we're all facing under global capitalism. Thanks.
So next, we're going to have a question for Lee. What is the impact of China's rise and the inter-imperial rivalry on the countries in the global south, particularly in Africa, where China is playing a greater role? Is this a new scramble for Africa?
Okay. Hey, everybody. So I guess to start with the last part of that question first, I would say yes, there is a new scramble for Africa, but it also, there has been a kind of different waves of this new scramble for Africa. Currently, people have probably been seeing, there's a lot in the news about the development of critical minerals, electric vehicles, and the sort of everything that goes into that, and that's sort of prompting a new discussion about this and a language about, debt trap diplomacy on the part of China and so on. But actually, in the period that Kevin just finished laying out, I mean, towards the early phase of this massive economic boom and industrial growth in China was really marked by an earlier new scramble for Africa around 20, 25 years ago. And I think what Kevin was saying about the way in which the growth of the Chinese economy is implicated in the neoliberal period and global capital as a whole, it can be seen very clearly in how this process played out. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, that and just to kind of step back a little bit, but the project of neoliberalism was a project of opening up the world's markets to global capitalism and through all kinds of devices that was done through driving down tariffs and privatization and so on through the international financial institutions, the World Bank and the IMF. And really, you know, and this is a lot, I go into this in my book, and there's a little bit about this here, but essentially that Global South economies, particularly in Africa, were essentially had some of that very nascent industrialization halted and so on, and a very highly developed focus on the development of raw materials. Mm-hmm. Now, and this is not an argument that then colonialism has returned to places like Africa in identical form as it did, or, you know, that dynamic, but it is a similar, there are elements that are similar, and this was a product of, in large part, the neoliberal era, mm-hmm. Global economic crises, and everything that sort of developed from there, including a debt crisis. China, in the period where it was seeking to rapidly accelerate its industrial development to grow its economy, saw African trade and raw material extraction and so on as a key part of that strategy and made a fairly sharp turn. And so you started to see, just as with Western capital, which has been very heavily implicated in Africa for a very long time, but similarly, large mining operations, a big push really for oil and gas, which drove that industrial expansion. And along with that, and this is where really, I think, you know, the inter-imperial rivalry played out on the continent precisely because it was the push to sustain and for China to elevate itself on the world stage that pushed this further. And so just as you see with Western global capitalism, there was essentially a race to the bottom in terms of conditions that workers on the African continent played, you know, wages forced down, and of course pretty severe environmental devastation and so on. So this is like I'm boiling down a pretty long history here, but then it's also been seen in other concrete ways. I mean, China, the African continent, the nation of the African continent became, China was the largest trading partner. The debt now currently of Chinese debt is already a fifth of what the International Monetary Fund has on that continent, which just shows, I think, an immense involvement and underpinning in these economies. But it's not just an economic process. There was a process of building political allegiances, and part of that was through things like these big infrastructure booms that have happened for the past couple of decades in Africa that were funded by China. Again, this was very much a competitive move on the part of Chinese capital and the Chinese state to build up political allegiances in a period where, you know, U.S. imperialism did not have strong relationships in that part of the globe. And so it was both an integrated and a political and economic project, essentially. And so, you know, there's large infrastructure projects, railways, bridges, and so on that were built. And a lot of this was sort of the early versions of what now the Belt and Road Initiative, which has become a huge global footprint. And, And this is something I think we could talk about later, in that is how the left has understood this, because part of what Chinese imperialism has looked like in places like Africa is that it was seen as, you know, sort of a way to throw off Western austerity conditionalities and, you know, barter agreements, oil for bridges and so on, and look at the, you know, potentially the hospitals and schools that are built and so on. And I think that there's a lot to say about that. There's a lot of debate. But I think that what's clear is that the deep involvement of Chinese capital, and it is capital, is very much an imperial project and is being driven forward by this rivalry that Ashley and Kevin spoke about. So I wanted to just, there's so much to say here. First of all, I'll just make two really quick points. One is, and some people may have been in the meeting yesterday on killer debt. I mean, right now there's actually a massive debt crisis in the global south, and some have basically characterized this as, like, people from the Committee to Abolish Illegitimate Debt and so on, as one of the worst debt crises. Mm-hmm. And certainly there's a sort of, again, this kind of understanding that I think the U.S. and Western governments are now trying to sort of repivot a little bit back to Africa, and maybe I'll talk about this in the next round of questions, because I think it relates to the fight over strategic minerals and so on. Mm-hmm. But this is a debt crisis that is massive, but also what's going along with that is renewed resistance and so on. People may have seen, for example, like over the summer, this incredibly courageous and strong movement that in Kenya that rose up to stop the imposition of new taxation, which was in response to a $2 billion a debt on the part to the IMF. So that's one particular dynamic that's happening right now, and I think that there's, you know, well, I'll get to how that, continue the thought in the next question. The other is, again, about climate, about fossil fuel extraction and the climate destroying the acceleration of this kind of extraction at the same time where there is an unfolding drive for strategic minerals, green minerals to support the energy transition. So you've got some real contradictions there. Mm-hmm. And in which other states, other sort of middle powers and other imperial powers are also in the mix, and in which the U.S. has become now is turning again with more attention to that. And there's military implications of that, which again I can talk more about when I'm not running out of time. But I think it's just to sort of end on this, is that, I mean, places in the global south where this kind of dirty extraction is still happening, the global capital wants to squeeze. And like there was a quote from Saudi Aramco spokesperson who said, well, we want every last molecule. They don't want to give up fossil fuels until they absolutely have to. And they're pursuing a double-edged strategy. And both Chinese and Western capitalism are deeply implicated in both of that. So anyway, I'll come back to that more in the next section.
For those who are either standing along the side or sitting down, there are chairs available. People put their hands up and show maybe where there are some chairs they can take a seat. Or if you want to stand, no judgment. The next question is going to go to Ashley. How has the U.S. responded to China's rise as a great new power? And furthermore, how has this played out within the United States itself?
Well, I'll start by just reminding people that this, as a strategic, competitive, inter-imperial dynamic, is pretty new. Because before the Great Recession, the U.S. treated China as a strategic partner, actually. Whatever containment elements there were in the relationship between the U.S. and China, the predominant characteristic was engagement, really since Mao and Nixon met in the early 1970s and created a rapprochement to unite against the Soviet Union back during the waning days of the Cold War. And Deng Xiaoping really solidified the relationship between the U.S. and China with his opening up to global capitalism. And after the repression of the Tiananmen Square uprising, U.S., Japanese, and European capital overcame any moral qualms they had and flooded investment into China to turn it into an export processing zone for multinational capital, as the U.S. and other advanced capitalist powers did to countries all over the world. They attempted to turn the world into an export processing platform for their products, undermining labor in their home countries and exploiting super cheap labor in China for profit. And that was with the collusion of the Chinese state. But the Chinese state didn't privatize all their state-owned industry, and they required the multinationals that came flooding into China to partner with state corporations within China and with private Chinese capital to transfer technology so that China could develop its own capitalist, indigenous, state-owned, and private capitalist power. The U.S. really began to shift its relationship with China from a strategic partner to what they then called it a strategic competitor, and now a great power rival after the Great Recession. That's when the relationship really begins to dramatically change. The U.S. is in the midst of suffering relative imperial decline. That is, the recession hammers the U.S. in particular, while China's stimulus makes it continue to boom for another decade until the pandemic recession, and China actually became the epicenter of global growth. So the U.S. is suffering relative economic decline. Then the Iraq and Afghanistan's wars further weaken U.S. imperialism on its military capacity to enforce its rule in the strategic center of global capitalism in the Middle East. And in that context, China becomes more and more assertive of its own imperial ambitions economically, geopolitically, and militarily. So that's when things really begin to shift. And you can document the shift with each successive U.S. administration. The Obama administration launches, in the aftermath of the Great Recession, its so-called pivot to Asia. That is, redeploying 60% of its naval forces to the Asia Pacific. And it tried to get the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement passed, which would have locked in all of Asia into a neoliberal pact that excluded China because of its state-owned capital. And then the U.S. also, under Obama's pivot, attempted, well, the program was to lock in alliance structures throughout Asia in particular against China. But Obama's pivot dramatically fails. The U.S. remains bogged down in the Middle East. They don't redeploy their naval forces. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement dies, doesn't even ever come up for a vote because of domestic opposition to free trade deals. And because the U.S. isn't able to carry out this pivot, states throughout Asia begin to balance between China and the United States. So the U.S. really faces a crisis at the end of the Obama administration. Trump comes in and abandons what had been the great power strategy of the United States of superintending global capitalism and incorporating all the states of the world under its aegis for great power rivalry with two states that the national security document itemizes, China number one and Russia number two. For whatever reason, you know, Trump never really went against Putin, and we're still trying to figure that out. Whatever documents Putin has on Trump, we don't know. After the revolution, we'll find out these internal documents. But he was very serious about China. Tariffs, new industrial policy begins to get floated for the first time at showing the ending of the neoliberal era. And then after the pandemic, whipping up vicious anti-Chinese racism, anti-Asian racism, not just for racism's sake and diverting attention from the U.S. culpability for the pandemic disaster in this country, but it's about research and education. And it targets Chinese researchers in the United States and Chinese foreign grad students in particular. But Trump was such an erratic, unstable character that he doesn't really implement a coherent strategy. It falls to the Biden-Harris administration to develop and implement the most coherent imperial strategy vis-a-vis China yet. That's why anybody who says that the Biden-Harris administration is somehow a simple lesser evil really has to read what they're doing with China. They've developed a strategy that I've called imperialist Keynesianism, of trying to implement an industrial policy to redevelop the U.S. manufacturing base, especially in high tech, especially in microchips. Hence the CHIPS and Science Act, which plows $280 billion into higher education and plant and machinery development in the United States so that it's less dependent on Taiwan. That's one of the big things that they did, jacking up tariffs on everything, despite saying it's a high fence and a small yard, which is their defense of their tariff. It keeps going. More and more tariffs are getting put on Chinese exports. And the other thing that Biden does is bandwagon all of its allies internationally against China. So the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, now sees China, which is in the Asia Pacific, so NATO, Asia Pacific, as a number one strategic competitor of European capital and NATO as an alliance. The U.S. under Biden and Harris do the same thing with developing a whole lattice network of geopolitical alliances and then a massive escalation of military investment by the Biden administration in the Asia Pacific to contain China's rise. And all of this is intensifying the rivalry that I talked about in my opening comments. And the sluggish growth of the world economy is only going to intensify this dynamic, because the industrial policies are not restoring adequate growth and profitability of either U.S. capital or Chinese capital. And so these countries are on a collision course in the world geopolitical, economic, and military arena, and it's very frightening.
I'm going to turn it back to Lee for this question. What are the flashpoints of this rivalry internationally, including in the global south, and how does this play into the rise of BRICS, or if people don't know what BRICS are, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, this like economic...
And South Africa, yes. I'll start there. I mean, I think that part of what is leading to more intensified competition and the sort of instability that Ashley is talking about is that there are, as I was mentioning before, there's the aspirations of the sort of medium size and smaller powers and so on, and certainly putting together, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, that these are, they're a band of hostile brothers, for one. They have competing interests, competing goals, and aspirations. They both have, they are not necessarily, I think, positioning, and this is sort of the debate I referred to earlier, I think a sort of, they're not a throwback to some kind of, you know, left alternative to global capitalism. And part of the process of the way in which this inter-imperial rivalry has played out, and the sort of intensified investment in Africa on both sides, has been also the development and the sharpening of new African ruling classes, for one, and elsewhere in the global South. So it's not just, you know, South Africa is the most industrialized nation, for example, but there are large economies, Nigeria, Egypt, and so on, and these regional powers have a heavy hand. And so, for example, now, and if people haven't read the work of Adam Hanea and his work on the Gulf States and extraction, it's excellent. And he has written about, for one, how the UAE has now has invested three times more FDI than China into Africa just over the past 2 years, which is kind of stunning. And this is, an investment mostly in green minerals and so on. So all of these, this sort of competitive rush is going to further instability on, both on a sort of regional, but on a global scale. And so I mentioned about the energy transition. I mean, there's most of the minerals that are required for at least the energy transition that has, the path that has been defined at least up till now, is rooted around strategic green minerals, copper, cobalt, lithium, and so on. Most of these are found in large quantities in Latin America, in Africa, and so on. And China is way far out ahead of the whole process, and in terms of control over all the global supply chain. They account for 60% of worldwide production and 85% of processing capacity, which is just a mammoth kind of share of that whole process. And so that is what's going to push the intensification further in any number of flashpoints around the globe, it's already begun to in Africa, but I think what we're going to begin to see more is how the ways in which this spills over into military conflict as well. And again, I didn't bring up the military component until just now because I think that there tends to be a confusion on the left about that imperialism equals, armaments and tanks and so on. But I do think that there's a dynamic here. I mean, Ashley talked about the pivot to Asia and so on and the militarization of that region. But the first overseas base that China established, for example, was in the Horn of Africa, mm-hmm. in a country called Djibouti, and it shares this very small, corner, essentially, with the United States' massive military base there, along with several other European powers like Italy and so on. This is the area where the Gulf of Arabia, the Red Sea, Suez Canal, kind of a key chokehold and so on for goods. This is, I think there's a kind of direct military ramping up that's been happening there for about two decades, but China has also been very involved in, for example, UN peacekeeping deployments and so on. There's a kind of a furthering of their military footprint on the continent, and I think that there's, alongside of this, there's been an increase in more outbreaks of civil war and instability, which I think is not surprising given the past two decades of this sort of so-called scramble for Africa and competition, and it's and the ways in which different powers, global powers and so on, take sides, pursue interests and so on. It's not, it's a complicated picture, but I think overall has produced a level of political and social and economic instability that has very quickly spilled into, unfortunately, a return to a level of civil wars on the African continent that had not been seen for some time. So I think that's the picture, that's the kind of point where you ended up on in terms of the instability, and I think it's sort of playing out in a very frightening way. And people who know, for example, about the Democratic Republic of Congo, where these very key strategic minerals are based, and some of the militarization that's happening around there and so on, it's quite shocking. So I think just to say that it's important to us as the left to understand this and to get this right and to not confuse things like these alternate formations like BRICS and so on, and particularly China as being somehow that this is a project for a developmental project or about some kind of we're just here to do business and this type of thing, that there's a real urgency about the ways in which this clash has been developing into these particular parts of the world where there's some real strategic conflicts that are brewing.
Dennis, can I just say one thing? I'll flag this for the discussion, but the sharp military flashpoints that we should be watching, where the U.S. and China are bound up, Ukraine, China's backer of Russia, Palestine, the U.S. is the main genocidal imperial power backing Israel, but China's the second largest trading partner with the State of Israel and wants normalization because Belt and Road is all over the region, and the oil reserves are there. So there's inter-imperial dynamics there. Obviously, Taiwan I talked about, but the one I want to flag is the battle in the South China Sea over the militarization of islands, in particular the Philippines, where the U.S. is doubling down on military bases that go all the way back to the Spanish-American War against China, which is pushing into Philippines' sovereign territory in the seas. And that's going to be a major flashpoint. All the different small countries, Japan included, are wrapped up in this, and that's a cauldron waiting to explode.
Got it. So let's go back to Kevin. China now oppresses nations and national minorities within its territory and threatens other nation states near and abroad, just like Ashley had mentioned. So can you talk more about what this looks like?
Sure, and I think, you know, the really important point in both Lee and Ashley's responses is that the U.S.-China rivalry is really not only about U.S. and China. It pretty much envelopes the entire world, in much of Latin America, Africa, Middle East, many parts of Europe. Here in the U.S., China is either the first or second trade partners and are intertwined in many different socio-economic and political ways. So I think when you think about U.S.-China rivalry, I really do not think only of those two countries. And I suppose you mentioned the situation in Africa, as well as the situation in the Asia-Pacific region, is actually quite relevant or implication of the rivalry and how it's going to play out. And I think that's probably going to be the trajectory. It's not going to be just U.S. and China going at each other. It's going to have kind of ramification all through the rest of the world. So in the book, so one of my co-authors writes about the so-called national questions. So we look at, in the book itself, we look at Tibet, we look at Xinjiang or the Uyghur region, we look at Hong Kong and Taiwan. So in the book, we go through the history of each and its relations with China or Chinese state. And obviously, there's very different dynamics at play in Tibet and Xinjiang. There is a settler colonialism, but in Hong Kong, obviously, and Taiwan, which is de facto independent country, its relationship is very different. We kind of flag those issues because we, in the book, we want to challenge ethno-nationalism and its implications for, you know, how Han Chinese people relate to Tibetans or Uyghurs or Hong Kongers or Taiwanese. And so in the book, we go through the history of that. And I should also just add, I think it's important to look at also other places, for example, the Philippines. I think that's where it gets overlooked because it's not a hot topic here. But actually, under the Biden administration, the U.S. really has been building up close alliances with countries in the region to encircle China. Mm-hmm. And the conflict right now in the either the, what you call the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea, it's actually has been getting quite a lot of quite getting heated, and I think sort of thinking about this through more a activist or organizing kind of political intervention angle, I've been speaking with labor movement leaders in the Philippines to think through about these questions, because this U.S.-China rivalry gets played out quite differently politically in different places, depending on the relations with both U.S. and China, and also depends on their own history. So in places like South Korea, which has a very strong anti-imperial tradition on the left, they really see the main enemy as the U.S. imperialism. But if you go to some place like Taiwan, the politics is different. They primarily see China as the bigger threat for understandable reasons, whereas they see U.S. as kind of not a banal necessary actor or on this side, but a useful ally to partner with. And then you go to somewhere like the Philippines, where also has a very rich and strong anti-imperialist, anti-US imperialist tradition. At the same time, the kind of nationalism on the left, not just on the right, on the left, is also there. So it also shapes how people think about the rivalry. And then, of course, you know, coming back to Latin America, a lot of leftists in Latin America welcome Chinese investment because that's a better alternative than whatever IMF and World Bank gave to them on conditionality. And then in Africa, it's also play out differently. So kind of from a left perspective, I try to think through these questions, not just as a one-off, you know, there's only one perspective on this. You have to do this in dialogue with the left and social movement in different countries and understand why they're thinking the way they do. And I think this is kind of our project, you know, the book project is whatever is something we've done. And going forward, you know, we're organizing a big conference next January, also in Chicago. And I hope we can build on that and build coalitions to really think through not just people here in the US and activists from China, but also people from other parts of the world who are also concerned about this US-China area and really build an independent and international, truly internationalist position on this.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.